Is it too late for our education system? Thankfully, education has become a political issue this year. Our standards are dropping, and we really have to do something about them. But is there a real political or bureaucratic will to do so? Dr. Nina Hood from the Education Hub is here to talk about this. First, she explains to me a little of her background and what the Education Hub is.
Thanks so much for having me. So yes, I am a former teacher. I started my career as a secondary school teacher before moving into the research space and doing a PhD and briefly becoming an academic. And I now run the Education Hub, which is a not-for-profit organisation with a mission to bridge the gap between research and practice in education. So we take the research on topics that matter to teachers and we put it into forms that are easily accessible, practical and usable for teachers.
So do you work directly with schools or do you work one-on-one with teachers who come seeking your support?
We do both, actually. So we're a fully online organisation, so all of our resources are available through our website. And we have both individual teachers as well as schools and early childhood centres working with us.
So let's talk about the state of education in New Zealand then. In 2023, we're constantly being told that standards are dropping. They have been dropping regularly for two decades or so now. For a start, is it true that our standards are lower than they were at the turn of the century? And if so, why?
So the data would suggest that yes, in a number of curriculum areas, our standards are slipping. So we know that in reading, writing, maths, science, particularly over the last sort of decade to 15 years, we have seen a decline in levels across those subjects among New Zealand school children. The reasons, no one knows for certain, and we most likely there are a range of different reasons for why those standards are slipping. Some of the things that are frequently highlighted are around the role that the curriculum plays in terms of shaping what's taught. And the fact that at the moment we have a curriculum that where there's very little content specified. And so what children learn at different schools and sometimes even in the same schools can vary quite widely. Issues around pedagogy, so that's the way that teachers are actually teaching and that in some cases it may not be as effective as it could be for supporting the learning of all our students. And then we also know that we've got an increasing role of technology and digital devices, and there is a growing body of evidence to suggest, particularly in areas such as reading and writing, that this likely is also contributing to the declining standards.
And what about the great unmentionable in this area, and that is truancy and poor attendance? Surely that must have an impact as well, doesn't it?
Absolutely. So we know that if our students aren't at school, it's really hard for them to be learning what it is we want them to be learning. So absolutely. And there's data to show that those students who are absent more frequently than others, on average, have poorer outcomes. It's quite easy to see the link and why that link would exist. But I think also what we need to be thinking about when we talk about truancy, some of the reasons why students aren't at school. And there are a range of different reasons, some of them social, some of them from outside of school. But we also know that one of the reasons why some students aren't going to school is because they've been completely failed by the school system. So if you have a 15-year-old who has never been taught to read, who's never been taught basic maths properly, you know, they have been utterly let down by our schooling system. So why should they go to school is the question I would ask, because they've been completely failed by it. They haven't been supported to develop the skills. They don't see a future for themselves in school. So I think that, yes, we know that truancy and absenteeism is having a significant impact on the learning outcomes for some students. But I think it's really important to think about what's happening within our schooling system that may be contributing to part of that.
So the obvious question it would seem to ask is, why have we changed the system? Why have we changed the curriculum? Because I went to school in the 1960s and early 70s. Maybe you were years slightly after that. But we had a system. We taught kids to read and write right from the age of five. It seems that we have gone away from doing the basics. Why did we do that?
Well, I don't think it's fair to characterise the system as having completely gone away from doing the basics, right? So, yes, of course, there is an expectation that children are taught to read, write and do maths, and to do that right from the get-go. I think some of the things that have happened is around how we're actually teaching some of those skills and some of that knowledge. And so there are questions about whether we're actually doing that in a really effective way. And, it is working for some students. So just, it's not like all our students are being failed by the school system. We are getting a proportion of our students through the schooling system with really high levels of literacy and numeracy. So we are still focusing on that. It's just, I would argue that some of the teaching methods that have been commonly utilised in New Zealand schools are not supporting all students to develop those skills and to develop that knowledge. And we also know that our specific intervention programs aren't always as well suited to the needs of students as they need to be, and are not particularly accessible for all students. So we're always going to have some students that are going to need extra support. And we need to be making sure that the interventions that we have in place for them are actually fit for purpose and are able to be accessed by those students.
I want to talk about a couple of terms. You've already mentioned one, and I see it seems to be written regularly in the new curriculum or curriculum summary. The word is pedagogies. What does that mean?
So pedagogy means the act of teaching. It's the how you are actually teaching students. And so we know that in New Zealand there has been a push over the last 10 to 20 years away from what we might call explicit teaching. So explicit teaching is where it's teacher-directed. And by teacher-directed, I don't necessarily mean the teacher at the front of the classroom just lecturing the class, but it's the teacher thinking really carefully about how they sequence a lesson, how they sequence a series of lessons to build the knowledge and skills of students. They are providing really clear direction around how sort of the process of how they teach students and guiding students through that process. So that's sort of the more explicit side of teaching. And a lot of schools have gone away from that sort of model towards a more student-directed approach to learning, where students are required to take on a far greater agency in terms of shaping their own learning. And in some cases, it's determining what they learn. In some cases, it's determining how they learn. And what we know is that particularly for younger students and for when students are just starting to engage with a particular topic, actually having more explicit teacher-guided instruction can be incredibly valuable in establishing that foundational knowledge that they need before they can then go on and engage in those sort of higher order thinking skills and in that more self-directed learning. So what we're seeing is that in some cases, there's not enough support for students to actually be engaging with the knowledge and skills that we want them to be engaging with, and so that they actually really learn that foundational knowledge.
So what you're saying is that from the age of five or whenever children start school, there are some basics they should be taught, and it comes back to reading. I guess in the old days we called it phonics, structured reading, whereby you learn how to read through putting a sound to a letter. And then when it comes to basic maths, basic addition, subtraction, multiplication, it's about learning that one and one are two is the most basic of the sums. So should there be more of that taught at an early age before we move to what we might call child-centered learning?
So my answer to that is yes and no, because I think we always need to achieve a balance. So yes, do I think it's absolutely essential that, say, for literacy, we are explicitly building up that phonological awareness, so what you were talking about around the letter sound correspondence and then the ability to blend those to form words. Yes, the evidence is really clear that you know, most children will require and benefit from that structured approach. That doesn't then mean that we don't also give them opportunities to be engaging with really rich language, to be reading picture books, to be read to, and to be exploring, you know, a wealth of different literature alongside that. And I think we've also got to make sure that we're thinking about at any stage. So for your younger thinking about the amount of time, for instance, that you would expend on explicit instruction, and then giving them opportunities to engage in more unstructured learning or in play opportunities. So thinking about that, and then across any given topic, and this goes for any age really, is that when you're just embarking on teaching a new topic, whether that be in science, whether it be, you know, in English, whether it be in maths, having some explicit instruction, so setting out that foundational basic knowledge first.
And then what, give the students the opportunity to explore more concepts after that? Is that the idea?
It is. So we want to make sure that we're, as well as giving students, explicitly teaching students knowledge and skills, we're giving them the opportunity to practice those, to engage with those in creative ways that are requiring them to utilise critical thinking skills, that are requiring them to solve problems and to actually utilise and apply the knowledge that they've learnt in new ways and in really creative ways as well.
So is there a lack of specifics in the curriculum? Do we not put enough emphasis on teaching knowledge in the curriculum at the moment, even with the new refreshed curriculum?
So if we look at the current curriculum, we do have, in my opinion, an issue with it because it does lack a lot of, it lacks any sort of specific content in it. So what it provides is high level objectives across the different curriculum areas, but it's up to individual teachers or individual schools to determine exactly how they're going to meet those objectives, the nature of the content that they're going to utilise. And as a result, we know that the educational experiences and the opportunities to learn can vary widely across different schools. So, for an example, there's been some research that's shown that in some secondary schools, students will never be required to read a novel or to do a novel study within English. They're always focusing on shorter texts. And so for me, I do believe that that's a problem because I think encountering rich language, encountering longer texts is actually something really important to be building in our students. If we look at the curriculum refresh, and what I would say is that it's not complete yet. We don't actually have the final drafts for most curriculum areas. One of the things they have been looking at doing is how they can provide some more structure around what it is that we're wanting students to learn. But at the moment, from what I've seen, there is still, I would argue, a lack of content and a lack of specificity in there. But it is quite possible that they may be doing more work in that area and may be providing more guidance for teachers. We're just yet to see what that looks like.
So it seems that the new curriculum is full of, what do they call them, competencies. Now, is that an acceptable concept to be putting into a school curriculum? Wouldn't it be better to have far more specific content about what should be taught, not just in the top decile schools, but in the lower socioeconomic schools as well?
So for me, it's a both and. So if we think about what it is we want young people to come out of schooling with, what is it that we value? What is it that we want them to know and be able to do? I think we'd all say that competencies, so things like being able to think critically, to be able to manage yourself, to be able to engage in learning, to be able to communicate effectively, are all things that we want them to be able to do. But what we also know is that those competencies don't exist in isolation from actual content knowledge or learning. So what we know is that, for example, the ability to think critically is reliant on having some really strong knowledge to think critically about. You can't think critically about nothing. Similarly, the ability to communicate, well, yes, we have, they can go across a range of different. Ultimately, the ability to communicate effectively is reliant on your knowledge of the topic that you're communicating about. So for me, it's about how we marry the competencies with the content knowledge and think about what they look like in relation to the different disciplines. And I think arguably that's something that we haven't done particularly well to date in education in New Zealand.
So who is driving the current curriculum refresh? What is the... Is there an ideology in the Ministry of Education which is at odds with the way that you think and the way that many other educational academics think?
So I would say that one of the things that worries me hugely about education in New Zealand at the moment is the increasing polarisation that exists among different people within it. I think if I think about myself, I would like to think that I don't sit too strongly on either side, and I can see that there are benefits and ideas of value from sort of both ends of that way of thinking. Yes, I think you could definitely argue that there has been some very strong ideology at play in terms of some of the policies that have been put forth by the ministry and some of the dominant thinking in education in New Zealand. And I think what it's really important for us to be able to do is to look at those ideas and look at any of the policies and any of the ideas coming out and think about, well, how does that relate to the evidence that we have from research and research from around New Zealand and around the world about how people learn, about how best to structure teaching and learning, and to really think about how we can bring what's currently happening in our policy, what's currently happening in our schools, into closer alignment with what we know from the research evidence.
So I was reading a piece written by Michael Johnson from the New Zealand Initiative, and I don't have the actual words in front of me, but he has talked about the curriculum philosophy, I suppose, and in particular the teaching of maths. And I think his phrase was something like, from the curriculum refresh is a sentence which is similar to this one. We should not dismiss the reality that maths are not a cultural construct. Now, I'm sorry, as a Pākehā white male, I struggle with the fact that maths can cross racial and ethnic lines. Isn't that bizarre kind of thinking, if that in fact is what is being put forward in this new curriculum?
Well, no, I don't think it's entirely bizarre. So we know that in all cultures and all countries around the world, they have maths thinking and maths concepts built into them. And they may not necessarily align exactly with the language that is used in, you know, sort of your dominant maths that you'd see and that you're talking about here. So I don't think that it's completely ridiculous. I understand where that idea is coming from, but for me it's about saying, how do we draw on those different ways that different cultures understand maths and think about them, but how do we then also think about how we are teaching maths concepts in schools and how we're building a really strong mathematical knowledge among our young people and the way that we're structuring that teaching. So it's not an either or, but I think it's really important for us to be thinking about when we're talking about maths and how we're teaching maths or how we're teaching any subject, is making sure that we are always building those foundational skills and building a really strong knowledge that students can then take with them as they continue to grow through a subject.
All right, I can understand that. What then do you make of the National Party policy that was released, a couple of weeks ago, where they talk about an instruction to teachers, every school, every class has to do 1 hour each day of reading, writing and maths. Do you believe that that is a worthwhile initiative, that we should get to the stage where we go back to basics that much, or is that just way too strict?
So I think they absolutely have a point that it is essential that we are making sure that every child comes out of our schooling system literate and numerate. And part of that is absolutely going to require us to think really carefully about what it is we're teaching and how we're teaching reading, writing and maths at all levels of schooling. So I absolutely agree that we need to be thinking really carefully about that. In terms of the 1 hour a day, well, my argument on that would be, if you've got 1 hour of really poor instruction, it really doesn't matter how long you're spending on it if the instruction's not good and if the content's not good. So I think absolutely we want to be teaching reading, writing and maths every day. We want to make sure that we're spending a good amount of time on them. But we've also got to think about what it is we're doing in those lessons, about how we are teaching those concepts. And also for something like reading and writing, we know that, yes, you want some dedicated literacy time, but we're also developing those skills across other curriculum areas as well. So when you're doing science, you know, you'll often be required to read something or write something. And similarly, if you're doing social studies. So I think we can think a little bit creatively about how it is we're addressing those whilst also making sure that we're building those foundational skills.
And what about the other strain of their policy, which was testing? People say, well, it's going back to the national standards of a decade or so ago, which are regarded as unsuccessful, even a failure. Do you believe that kids from the age of 7 or 8 should be tested regularly to see what progress they are making?
So I think it all depends on how we are defining testing. So, I mean, one of the things I've mentioned is using a tool like EAST or twice a year. I would argue that most schools are already doing something similar to that, using either the PAT or the EAST tool to measure their students twice a year. I think that it is really important for teachers to have a clear understanding of where each of their students are at, where they might have gaps, where they might need extra support. And so building in assessment to do that is incredibly important. I think what we've always got to be aware of when we're putting in some sort of formal testing regime is that we don't then let that slip into a high-stakes accountability measure, because what we know from all over the world is that those don't work. And that they create a whole load of unintended consequences around a narrowing of the curriculum, around a teaching to the test, which are not in the best interests of young people. So I think it's really important to think about how we're positioning that, and also making sure that we are supporting teachers to know how to utilise assessment information in order to be able to support their students and to support the pathways that their students are on. Because if we just put in a test and actually don't do anything with the data that it produces, then it's not actually going to have any impact on students' learning.
And what about teacher training? I mean, I'll put my cards on the table here. Both of my parents were teachers. They trained in the, well, a long time ago, late 40s, early 50s, when it was a two-year course for primary teacher training college. Now it's at least a three-year course, and it's a two-degree standard as well. Is teacher training at an acceptable level, and are we getting enough good teachers coming out the other end of our teacher training systems?
It's a great question. So I think that there needs to be a lot of work and thought given over to teacher training. And I think that extends across the whole of teacher training. So it looks at what it is we're actually teaching our trainee teachers, how we're teaching our trainee teachers, looking at how they're supported through their placements or the practicums when they're out in schools, and also thinking about, well, what happens when they leave their training and actually go into schools and the support and mentorship that they get in those first couple of years in the classroom. So we need to think about that whole continuum of it. And yes, I would agree that we have some fantastic people coming in to be trained to be teachers, and I'm sure that they go on to be fantastic teachers. But we also need to look at the standards of entry and how we support more people to become teachers, because one of the things we know is that we've got declining numbers of trainees across the country, and that is going to have flow-on implications for the workforce.
Yeah, and I hate to hark back to the old days, but teachers, when they went to teachers' college, were bonded, weren't they? So it was an attractive profession to go into because it was essentially a free education. You were paid a salary when you went through teachers' college, both at primary and secondary school level, and then you had to teach for 3-4 years out the other end to pay back your bond. And then you could decide after that what you happen. If you've got a shortage of students going into teacher training, is it worthwhile considering that kind of system again?
I think we need to think along those lines. So one of the things we know is that, to become a primary school teacher, you can do the 3-year Bachelor of Education, but you can also do a graduate diploma after you've done a previous degree. And that's also the route into secondary, doing a graduate diploma, a 1-year course. And what we know is that there are some people who aren't coming in to do that 1-year course because they can't actually afford to do it. Because if they've, you know, had been previously employed, they can't afford to take a year out of employment and pay fees to train to be a teacher. And so we do need to think about, well, how could we support people in that sort of circumstance to actually be able to do their teacher training and to enter the profession? So yes, I think there's much more we could do to think about how we are supporting that pipeline.
And talking of in-classroom standards, we have the ERA these days, the Education ERO rather, the Education Review Office coming by. Have they essentially taken the place of the old school inspectors, or is it not quite as thorough as the former inspectorate used to be, which from my personal knowledge, the presence of the inspectors in a school made teachers quite nervous for the week that they were around?
So we do have, so yes, the Education Review Office, ERO, has replaced the school inspectors in the school inspectorate. And they are in a process of refining their process and how they work with schools. In terms of, does it strike fear into the heart of teachers? I think possibly for some, not necessarily for others. But for me, it's about thinking really carefully when we're thinking about those school inspections, about being really clear about what it is we are wanting to see, what it is we're going to be valuing, and how we're going to be understanding and assessing that. And then also thinking on the other side, well, how do we then work with and support schools that might need some extra support in particular areas, and what does that whole process look like?
And I guess the ongoing issue that so many teachers have, particularly at secondary school level, although it appears from the anecdotal knowledge that I have at primary school level as well, children's behaviour. Just how much of a problem is this for teachers to be able to do their job properly? Because you get so many stories, particularly from the high school teachers, that it's just impossible for them to be able to impart knowledge because of the way the kids carry on.
Yeah, there is a growing amount of anecdotal evidence, and it's from primary and secondary schools around challenging behaviour that they're noticing in young people. And that is a huge issue, because if you have, you know, that if you're having to focus your time on behaviour and managing behaviour, then that does absolutely mean that you're not able to actually move on to the actual teaching of content that you really want to be doing. So you are limiting that. So yes, the evidence would suggest that this is a growing problem and that it is increasingly impacting teachers and their ability to really do their role.
But also it's an issue of what the heck do we do about it, because the discipline options are not what they were in times gone by. And far be it from me, I'm not suggesting we go back to the days of corporal punishment, but just an ability for teachers to be able to instill some disciplinary measures must surely be put in place to be able to somehow curb this issue.
So, yes, we want to make sure that schools have in place structures to really manage that student behaviour and have really clear expectations and follow-throughs on those expectations. And what we know from the research is that having a whole school approach to that is the most effective way to do it. But what I'd also say is that if a child is acting out, if behaviour becomes an issue, the behaviour is a symptom of something else that's going on for that child. And so what we also need to be making sure is that we are providing that range of support systems and support services within schools that enables those schools to be working with those children that are being disruptive, that are presenting with challenging behaviour, to get them the support that they need, because there's something else going on for that child that is resulting in them behaving like that. And what I would suggest is that at the moment, we don't have good enough support systems within our schools to be able to provide the level of support that schools need. So yes, we need to be making sure that we've got the behaviour policies and the behaviour management systems in place in schools and in classrooms, but we also need to be providing that additional layer of support for individual students.
So what do you mean by the extra layer of support? Are you almost advocating for social workers to be attached to a lot of schools to be able to work outside the classroom with the troublesome students to try and investigate what's going on at home, to have non-teaching staff as part of the staff at a school to try and work with the disruptive kids?
So, yes, I believe that we need to think about our schools far more holistically. We know that teachers are having to take on more and more additional roles that fall outside of that core teaching role, and that are having they have a massive burden on teachers. So, yes, I think we need to think about the range of different support services that we need to see in schools. So, yes, part of it could be around social workers, part of it could be around counsellors, part of it could be around health support within schools. So I think we need to think about schools in a different way to how we've thought about them in the past, and that they're not just a place for where teaching and learning occurs, but they become far more of a community hub.
So who should be leading this, Nina? Should it be the Ministry of Education, or is it up to the school boards to do this kind of work?
I don't think that it should be just up to school boards to do this sort of work. So, I mean, increasingly I'm of the opinion that we need to do a complete rethink of our school system, because I don't think it aligns with what we know about how students learn. It doesn't align with changes that have happened in our society over the past decades. And so I think we actually need to have that whole scale rethink of what our schooling system looks like. And that ultimately has to come from the centre. It has to come from the Ministry of Education.
Okay, so what kind of wholesale rethink would you see? What would be the main features? If you were in charge, if you were now the Secretary of Education, if you were in Iona Halstead's job, what would you be looking to put in place in terms of a change of the way schools operate?
It's a great question. And the answer to that is I don't have a fully formed opinion yet. So I have lots of ideas whizzing around in my mind, but I don't have anything that is absolutely crystal clear and says we must do this, this, and this. But there are things that I think we need to look at. So one of the things I think we need to look at is essentially the way in which we structure schooling in terms of having these discrete years. So you progress through year one, year two, year three, year four. For me, that doesn't fit with what we know about how young people learn, and the fact that learning is not linear, that it goes in fits and starts. And I think having a greater degree of flexibility around that would be incredibly valuable. I think we need to think about how we've structured the school year and the way that that looks. I think there are a myriad of different things that we're wanting to be thinking about and looking at. I think we need to look at the curriculum, both in terms of how we think about the academic knowledge, but also how we think really carefully about what we know around the importance of social-emotional learning, what we know about the importance of developing executive function skills in young people. So for me, there are lots of different components to this work.
Some fascinating thoughts there, Nina. You talk about linear progression for kids. What about linear progression for teachers? Because they've been on strike recently, complaining about the fact that they don't think they get paid enough. Yet if they stay in a job for 8 years, they're going to get a pay rise every year. That's just the way the system works, whether they're good or bad at their job. Is that the way that teaching should be, that you just keep on moving up the scale despite how good or bad you are?
You're asking some good questions.
Sorry, I know a bit about this. Well, I like to think I know a bit about this because I lived with teachers for about 40 years of my life. So I have never been a teacher, but I know a little bit about it.
So I would answer that question to say that I think we need to think really carefully about career pathways and career progression in teaching. And for me, actually, part of the whole scale rethinking of the schooling system would be about thinking about those professional pathways for teachers. And so one of the things we know is that really at the moment in teaching, the only way to progress up once you hit the top of the scale is to move into your leadership positions. Well, that's great for some people, but for others, they don't want to be leaders. That's not what their skill set is. So I think we also need to think about those different pathways that we could create within education. So yes, you'd have one that's a leadership track, but I think you could also think about how you would have this sort of expert teacher track so that we're supporting the development of our really exceptional teachers and thinking about how they can then feed back into the system and be supporting other teachers as well.
And what about the real issue with staffing schools? That's the lack of male teachers, particularly in primary schools. How difficult is it for a young male to get into primary school teaching to be paid reasonably well and not have issues about contact with kids, for instance, and accusations being levelled at him by parents about perhaps striking the kids or administering too hard a discipline to the kids? I mean, it's not a particularly attractive job for a young man, is it, because of the restrictions being put on him?
Well, I would contest some of that at the primary school level. I think it's sad if it's not an attractive profession for a man to go into primary school teaching. I think teaching is a wonderful profession and it's full of, yes, it can be challenging and yes, it can be difficult, but it can also be incredibly rewarding and incredibly joyful. So if what you talk about is the case and that's a reason why men don't want to go into primary school teaching, then I think that is an incredibly sad situation and something that needs to be remedied.
And I don't know how it would be remedied. Just finally, though, Nina, are you pleased that education is back, shall we say, back on the agenda again? It always occurred to me that it was never much of a political issue, never much of an election issue, because kids don't vote and not all voters are parents of children. But it seems to me that in 2023, with the increasing awareness of our falling education standards, that it has become a political issue again. Already the National Party's policy has come out on it. No doubt there will be other party policies on education coming out as well. Is that a good thing? You've been featured in the New Zealand Herald series on education standards. I mean, we are talking about it again, aren't we? That's got to be a good thing, doesn't it?
So I think as a country, we absolutely need to be talking about what's happening in education. It's critical. And I mean, I am so deeply concerned about the state of education and some of the things that are happening. So I think in terms of raising that awareness is really positive. I think what can happen when education becomes hugely politicised is not necessarily going to be helpful in bringing about the sorts of changes that we need. We're starting to see parts of this, of education becoming a really divisive topic as well. And I'm not certain that that's going to be the most useful thing in education. I think I'm already seeing, just among people involved in education, a lack of ability to actually, with people with differing opinions, to actually come together and discuss these and to talk about them. And that deeply concerns me. And so I think we've got to think really carefully about how we make sure that education doesn't become a really strongly partisan topic, because I don't think that that will ultimately help us to create the types of changes that we need in the education system. But in saying that, turning a spotlight onto education and building an understanding among New Zealanders of some of the challenges that we're facing is a really positive thing.
True. But if there is no change of government, and if there is the same management at the Ministry of Education into the future as there is now, what hope do you give of standards improving?
Well, I think anyone in education has to remain an optimist, because if you didn't, it would just become far too depressing and you'd never want to get out of bed. There's part of me that always remains hopeful that things can change, but I am increasingly worried about the status quo.
Nina Hood, thank you so much for being so diplomatic and for talking to us today.
Thanks for having me.
And that was Dr. Nina Hood from the Education Hub. I spoke with her on Friday afternoon. Reality Check Radio, the Peter Williams Afternoon Show. If you've got any thoughts on that interview, your comments are most welcome through inbox at realitycheck.radio.